The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 9th of April 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme:
The United States is increasingly concerned by recent escalating Russian aggressions in eastern Ukraine, including Russian troop movements on Ukraine's border. Russia now has more troops on the border with Ukraine than at any time since 2014.
The White House spells out in no uncertain terms what the United States thinks of Russian maneuvers along its border with Ukraine. We'll hear from the Russia analyst Mark Galeotti. Then,
I'm Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak, and I'll be looking at whether a domestic corruption investigation in Austria has taken some of the shine off of the country's star chancellor, Sebastian Kurz.
Thanks, Chris. Plus, our Latin America correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, brings us the latest on Peru's upcoming elections and the region's answer to eBay. And we'll have our weekly assessment of what we've learned in the last 7 days. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Recent weeks have seen a significant build-up of Russian forces along its border with Ukraine. Within the last day, the threat has become even less thickly veiled, with one Russian official suggesting that those troops could cross the border to defend Russian-sympathizing separatists in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. The United States is now said to be considering sending warships into the Black Sea. This is not necessarily a huge deal. The U.S. Navy sails the Black Sea pretty regularly, so long as Turkey admits them through the Dardanelles Strait. However, in this instance, it would surely be interpreted as a hefty hint in Moscow's direction. Well, I'm joined with more on all this by Mark Galeotti, Senior Associate Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute and author most recently of A Short History of Russia. Mark, I'll start with the big question. Do we know what Russia's intentions towards Ukraine actually are right now?
We certainly don't. And to be perfectly honest, that's how Moscow wants to keep it. Whether there's some major military offensive planned is highly unlikely. But the key thing is this is very much about bringing pressure to bear on Ukraine. And in that respect, as far as Moscow is concerned, the more uncertainty, the better.
But when you talk about them bringing pressure to bear on Ukraine, to what end, from Moscow's perspective? Is this just a continuation of what they've been doing the last 7 years or whatever we're up to now, of just reminding Ukraine and the world that they can turn up or turn this conflict down as and when it pleases them?
There's an element of that, but I think the reasons why we're seeing it at the moment is, first of all, Ukraine's Zelensky has in some ways decided to try and reverse the fall in his political fortunes by taking a tougher line on pro-Moscow forces at home. Secondly, it's that with parliamentary elections coming up later this year in Russia, in some ways, the Kremlin needs a bit of a crisis just to justify its notion that the world is a hostile place to Russia, and that's why everyone needs to rally around the flag. And finally, this is anyway campaign season. April is when the thick muds of a Ukrainian winter anyway tend to dry. So we tend to see something of an upsurge at this time of year.
Because if Russia did have serious designs on Ukraine, or at least on any more of Ukraine, it would have made sense, would it not, to have pulled a stunt like this a year ago when the United States was presided over by a president who might have been less likely to take a guinness. Is there some element of Russia attempting to take the measure of President Joe Biden?
There may be, but to be perfectly honest, I mean, this is in some ways the kind of really overt pressure that Biden has to respond to. In some ways, they are actually forcing his hand, not because Ukraine will, as it's asked, be allowed to join NATO or similar. But, you know, Biden has to look tough in these circumstances. We've seen other testing of his new administration. This probably isn't one.
What are his options for actually looking tough, though? There is this chat about sending elements of the US Navy into the Black Sea, but as that's something they do pretty regularly, that wouldn't seem like that big a signal, would it?
Not really, particularly because under the Straits Convention, if you want to send a warship in or out of the Black Sea, you have to give 14 days notice. Now, we don't know if the Americans have formally submitted that yet, but nonetheless, this is clearly not instant response. And particularly given that the Americans had just sailed the Eisenhower nuclear-powered aircraft carrier battle group out of the Mediterranean through the Suez Canal, you know, it doesn't look like, in fact, the Americans really think this is all going to kick off. So, yes, this is all about signaling. This is all about trying to tell the Russians we are concerned, we are paying attention. But the bottom line is the Russians have what is called escalation dominance in the region. They can always turn up the heat more.
What would be the likely Russian response if the United States took the opposite tack then and just decided to ignore them?
Well, this has always been one of the fascinating questions. You know, the Russians know how they can yank the West's chain, if we can put it that way. And up to now, we have always responded as predicted. To be perfectly honest, if we didn't really respond, under normal circumstances, it would probably infuriate the Russians, but also quite possibly defang them. In this particular case, though, look, you know, Ukraine's sovereignty is genuinely at threat. And we have other NATO countries, such as starting with Lithuania, saying that NATO should be being more robust. I think by doing nothing in this particular instance isn't really a runner, because it would lead to divisions within NATO. But as a future policy generally, to not make Putin feel that he can make the West jump whenever he chooses, that would be well worth trying.
Because is it not arguably the case that any talk of what Russia's endgame in Ukraine is a bit redundant? They've already got it, haven't they? They've got Crimea, which they wanted, and they do have enough of a stake in the rest of Ukraine to ensure that, you know, Ukraine's ideas of joining NATO are forever on ice.
Well, the irony is, I mean, look, frankly, Ukraine's chances of joining NATO in anything less than a decade were anyway pretty much a non-starter. The thing is, Donbass was not meant to be this long-term commitment. When the Russians went in, and I remember I was in Moscow at the time, everyone was convinced that it would be a six-month operation. Within 6 months, Kyiv would have realized that basically it had to stay within Russia's sphere of influence. The boys would be brought home and everything would be fine. Now they've been stuck in this for 7 years, and there are costs. There are sanctions. The Russians are having to basically subsidize these sort of pseudo states of in the Donbass with all kinds of different ways. You know, this is expensive in many ways, not so expensive that the Russians have to pull out. But certainly this is not their ideal. This is their plan B or plan C. They're still hoping that somehow they can reach some kind of a deal with Ukraine, which means that, yes, they will still have some kind of say in Ukraine's future without having to maintain these two ramshackle, corrupt and violent warlord states in the Donbass.
Mark Galeotti, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Yolene Goffin with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. A respiratory expert has told the Derek Chauvin murder trial that George Floyd died from a lack of oxygen. Dr. Martin Tobin's claim contradicts the defense's case. Mr. Chauvin, a former police officer, was filmed kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck during his arrest. He denies the charges against him. Police in Northern Ireland have deployed water cannon for the first time in 6 years after coming under attack during rioting in Belfast. Northern Ireland Secretary of State Brandon Lewis is expected to hold talks with the country's political leaders in a bid to stem the violence. South Korea has unveiled the first prototype of the KF-X fighter jet it is developing in collaboration with Indonesia. It comes amid uncertainty over the future of Jakarta's role in the project. The next generation aircraft is designed to be a cheaper alternative to the US-built F-35. And hospitality establishments in England are preparing to reopen to customers for the first time in 2021. Customers will still have to eat and drink outside from Monday, but it marks a tentative return to normality. You can find out much more about it by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Yolene Goffin, thank you very much. In further breaking news, and this is just breaking in the last minute or two, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, husband of Queen Elizabeth II, has died at the age of 99. That has been confirmed by Buckingham Palace. We will doubtless have more on that throughout the day. For now, you are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24 and to Austria. One does not become the head of government of a reasonably serious country before one's 32nd birthday without being an effective, if not ruthless, political operator. However, the discovery that Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, now a wizened 34, is exactly such an intriguer is causing an amount of brouhaha. A cache of private text messages sent by Kurz has become public as part of an investigation into corruption. They reveal a pretty shameless arm twister and palm greaser, albeit one with a distinguishing fondness for emojis. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak. Chris, first of all, how and why did these messages become public?
So this goes back all the way to the rather infamous Ibiza scandal that that many of us will have heard about also on this show. I know you love this one, Andrew, yourself.
I was a big fan of the Ibiza scandal.
This was the scandal where the former deputy chancellor, far-right and far-right leader, Heinz Christian Strache, was caught on video offering political favors to someone he thought was the niece of a Russian oligarch. Strache himself, of course, had to resign. That precipitated another election in Austria. All of that, if you will, is in the past. But for the fact that Strache himself mentioned in that video that there was this casino operator, Novomatic, that basically offered political favors to all parties in Austria. And that triggered an investigation, as you can imagine, that went further reaching. And that's kind of where this all started. Finance Minister Gernot Blümel is kind of at the center of this. He's been named in a bribery investigation because the casino operator targeted him, for example, sending him a message saying they wanted a meeting with Sebastian Kurz, the chancellor, would offer a donation in exchange for them helping to solve a problem they had with Italy, a tax problem they had there. So that's kind of one of the things. Of course, the finance minister denies wrongdoing. As does the Austrian chancellor. They say a meeting never took place. And then there's a separate scandal over a confidant to Sebastian Kurz, Thomas Schmidt, formerly a deputy finance minister, who was then given a very plushy job as the head of Austria's state holding company. And this is the one that kind of touches on Sebastian Kurz himself, as well as the finance minister. There's these messages from Sebastian Kurz basically pushing for Schmidt to get this position, telling him you're getting everything you wanted. Kiss emoji, kiss emoji, kiss emoji to go with the emojis that you were talking about, sort of reassuring him that he would get this position. So that's kind of where all of this scandal has come up.
I mean, is there a big disconnect between what we see of Kurz in these texts and the public image he's always been at pains to present?
You know, it's interesting because I think in terms of his public image, he's a bit of a Teflon chancellor. You know, he's just nothing touches him very much. He's always, in the past at least, been very popular. He sort of brought personality politics, if you will, or person politics to Austria, to a country that before this was much more, you know, party politics focused rather than, you know, the chancellor being the focus. He made it all about him in the past and was seen as somebody who was fresh and new, you know, in Austria in terms of his approach, his sort of media savvy approach and everything else. But as you said in the outset, at the same time, he's also is known as a very wily political operator. So people, if you will, within Austrian politics recognize that he's not the squeaky clean, perhaps, you know, politician that maybe his outside persona suggests and that people in Austria might have seen. So in that sense, yes, it's sort of this scandal does impact him, you know, in terms of the public perception.
I mean, it's an eternal question, I think, with political scandals, especially of this kind, when the curtain gets whipped back. And it is, I mean, is anybody in Austria actually really surprised or scandalized by this, or are people basically just enjoying the show?
Well, it's interesting when you look at the polls, I have to say, because as I mentioned, like on the one hand, yes, political insiders especially are not necessarily scandalized, although the opposition is, of course, trying to make a big deal of this, calling for the finance minister's resignation, which he has so far said he will not do. But it is having an impact in the polls, which is the easiest way perhaps to measure that. One thing that's interesting is that even though the People's Party of Sebastian Kurz is still doing relatively well at around 36% in polls, Sebastian Kurz himself, if there were a direct election, if you will, of the chancellor, is down at about 29%. So he's sort of underwater compared to his party. And that's a reversal of even just last year when he had about 54% support among the public. And this is not just about the scandal, it's also about the coronavirus pandemic and the handling of lockdowns in Austria, it should be said as well. So that's just a sign that really the shine has come off of Sebastian Kurz over the last few weeks and months. And, you know, for a party that really has based its entire image at this point around the chancellor, that's a problem.
Finally, and just quickly, does this seem to you like the kind of scandal that is going to do him lasting damage?
Well, as I say, I think it could cause him lasting damage if he doesn't manage to recover that personal popularity, because all, you know, in the last election, he changed the party's name. He made it the Kurz List. You know, he changed the color of the party as well. So all of this was about a new start, a different type of politics. If he's not able to get past this scandal, you know, in terms of the image, the personal impact of the image it has on him, then yes, I think you could more easily see the People's Party itself, as well as politicians, you know, opposition politicians saying, we don't necessarily need this guy.
Chris Chermak, thank you for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Peruvians will vote in a presidential and general election on Sunday. As they choose a president, at least, they will be hoping for an improvement on their recent luck. Of the 8 most recent occupants of the office, 3 are either in jail or awaiting trial. 1 shot himself when the cops came calling. 1 resigned in disgrace. 1 was impeached, and the other 3, incumbent Francisco Sagasti included, weren't really there long enough to cause much trouble. I'm joined with more on this and other Latin America stories besides by our Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott. Lucinda, first of all, to Peru's presidential election, who is the front runner to be awarded this clearly poisoned chalice?
Well, we have 18 candidates, so far there is no front runner. Some are only polling around 5%, but among the top 6 is conservative Hernando de Soto. He's actually running for the top job for the first time, but he's not really new to politics. He was the former director of the central bank. He was a key economic advisor to the former president, Alberto Fujimori. And really, as an economist, his ideas sort of around property rights and deregulation are credited with helping to stabilize the Peruvian economy. So he's sort of popular with the Lima elite, with older voters perhaps, and the business community in Peru. And then the next up, we have a former mayor and actually a former football star who actually contracted COVID over the weekend. So that sort of put out his final week of campaigning. Three other candidates, I should mention, have also had the disease. But George Forsyth, he played as goalie for the national team and has really used his celebrity to enter politics, first in 2010 as a local MP in a working class district of Lima, and then afterwards as mayor in 2018 for La Victoria. Now, Forsyth's young, he's 38, and he's considered really a fresh face. You know, he has a big social media presence and sells himself really as a new generation of politician at a time of widespread frustration with the political class.
I mean, so this is very, very likely to go to a second round, right? We're not going to get a result on Sunday.
Well, as I say, there is no clear front runner. Seven of the 18 candidates are polling within the range of becoming one of the final two. And yes, if no candidate wins an absolute majority of votes, which given it is so fragmented and there are so many names on the ticket in the first round, it is likely that the top two will compete in a runoff, which is scheduled for June 6th.
I mean, this is another election, and we've now seen nearly a year's worth of them, which is in some respect or another a COVID-19 election. Is that looming as a meaningful issue in Peru, the government's handling of it, which has not been an advertisement?
Well, certainly. I mean, in Peru, we have to remember that we had a massive vaccine scandal only recently, much like in Argentina, where high-ranking officials skipped the queue for a vaccine. Almost 500 people jumped the queue, and that includes former President Martin Vizcarra. And this election is around that. There have been calls, actually, to cancel it, given that people will have to go out to the polls, and we have more than 50,000 Peruvians who've died from COVID. I think in terms of per capita, it's actually one of the worst in Latin America at the moment, at the height of the pandemic, where we have this new variant. But Martin Vizcarra, who was impeached, he was actually one of the most popular presidents of his generation. And over the past 2 years, he really pushed on these anti-corruption reforms. But it's a highly fragmented moment. And I think a lot of people, it'll be interesting to see how many people turn out on Sunday, given that the virus is raging.
Finally, and just quickly, for something completely different, a good bit of news from Latin America, the eBay of Latin America, creating thousands of jobs, and its founder lives quite close to you in Uruguay.
Yeah, so Marcos Galperin, he's the founder of Mercado Libre, which is the LATAM version of eBay that was set up in Argentina. He announced 16,000 jobs that will be created across the region, which is, you know, desperately struggling with mass unemployment brought on by the pandemic. And the site has seen a huge uptick in demand, just like Amazon during 2020, with more people being at home. And yes, he's based in Uruguay. He moved here alongside some of his senior management team last year from Buenos Aires. And well, the story is that it could be for tax reasons, because the government over there in Argentina is piling on wealth tax as it struggles, obviously, with one of the worst recessions in its history. But here in Uruguay, there's a fair amount of curiosity as to whether he will redirect some of his funds to local businesses and help with Uruguayan startups.
Lucinda Elliott, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And for more on Peru's recent bewildering presidential history, you can download episode 360 of The Foreign Desk from Monocle 24's website. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Mullett. Finally on today's show, and finally this week, our weekly assessment of what we know now that we did not know 7 days ago. We learned this week of another legacy of the recently outgone administration of former US President Benito Cartman. We're going to need some subtly evocative Italian background music. Subtly evocative? Look, forget it, whatever. Adam Curtis never has this trouble. Anyway, we learned that, with the rigorous attention to detail for which the 45th president was renowned, US Treasury sanctions imposed on Venezuela's state oil company shortly before Trump left office had accidentally blacklisted one Alessandro Bazzoni, the proprietor of the Dolce Gusto restaurant in Verona. It's on Via Sottomonte, 3.5 stars from 328 reviews on TripAdvisor. Happy to help. We learned, specifically the hapless pizza flinger in question learned when he attempted to operate his current account, that the United States had frozen the assets of the wrong Alessandro Bazzoni, possibly because they'd gotten crude oil confused with olive oil. Who knows? We did attempt to learn yet more and contacted Mr. Bazzoni for clarification. A penne for your thoughts, we said, but he hung up on us. Happens pretty frequently, in fairness.
Come on.
Get on with it.
We are obliged at this point to offer a right of reply to Monocle's Italy desk chief, Chiara Ramella.
Gesù santo, ma davvero? Non ci posso credere.
Maybe copy that one to the file? It seems reasonably likely to come up again.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again.
We also learned this week that, contrary to what you might well have heard on the actual news or read in reports by various human rights NGOs and similar troublemakers regarding China's oppression of its Uyghur minority, it's all just dandy in Xinjiang, the province in which the Uyghurs live. We learned this from the Chinese Communist Party, and would they lie to us, would they, about a thing like this? We learned that Chinese embassies around the world have taken to inviting groups of local hacks to a screening of a series of completely convincing and not remotely weird or creepy videos entitled Xinjiang is a Wonderful Land. From those mini-movies, which in no way resemble the pre-arrival film that might be screened on Air Dystopia, we learned that everybody in Xinjiang is completely happy about absolutely everything.
This is a land of happiness, where people's well-being is constantly improved.
So that's nice. Reassured further by that lulling background music, we also learned an interesting new simile for communal cohesion.
All ethnic customs and traditions are duly respected. In Xinjiang today, people from various ethnic groups live in concord, work in solidarity, and develop in harmony, bending together closely like the seeds of a pomegranate.
Like the seeds of a pomegranate. Liquid copywriting right there, lads. Elsewhere, we learned of Jay-Z's 100th problem.
From rags to riches, I ain't dumb. I got 99 problems, but a b- ain't one. Hit me!
It is a mosque in Lamu, Kenya, which has taken umbrage with America's 49th president, he'll be just after Eric Trump and just before the invasion by Cuba, over a T-shirt. Jay-Z was photographed leaving a pizzeria, not the one in Verona we met earlier, unfortunately, as it would have lent this week's monologue a cohesion of which, frankly, it shows no sign so far, wearing a garment featuring an image of Lamu's Riyadh Mosque, which, we learned, is an indisputably handsome building, if they don't mind us saying so, and it appears they might, because... We learned that the mosque's custodians were not flattered by the Big Pimpin' Hitmaker's homage and had expressed their vexation in a letter to the T-shirt's designer. This would be Kenyan couturier Zedekiah Lukoye, a.k.a. Zeddy Loki. When we learned this, we were pretty excited, as volleys of fire and brimstone from the religiously aggrieved are always good fun in these monologues. We get Fernando or Carlotta to read bits of them out like they're the dumbest thing they've ever heard. Seriously, check out the older episodes. It's always a total hoot. You can't get the staff. But we learned upon reading the letter from Riyadh Mosque, Secretary General Abu Bakr Badawi, that he'd made his point with courtesy and humility, saying he appreciated Zeddy Loki's promotion of Lamu, but would also appreciate his place of worship not featuring on nightclub apparel. While we tend, if we're honest, towards the view that maybe the Riyadh Mosque's management could afford to lighten up a bit, we're big fans of reasonableness, if that is indeed a word. Plus, along with the offending T-shirt, Jay-Z was wearing shorts, and he's 51 years old. So we're ruling in favour of the mosque. And... We learned of the lengths to which quarantine can drive a man. An Australian chap by the name of David Marriott recently returned after a necessary trip overseas and confined to a Brisbane hotel room for the statutory 2 weeks of isolation, assembled a sort of Wild West universe from the brown paper bags in which his rations were delivered. He built himself a brown paper horse, dressed himself in a brown paper waistcoat and brown paper chaps, and topped the look off with a brown paper hat. You know that clip of anticipatory dismay we premiered on Monday? Knew it would come in handy.
No, don't.
No, please don't.
Oh, God, Andrew, no.
Yes, local law enforcement now wants a word with this brown paper cowboy about... rustling. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. A reminder of the news which broke while we were on air. Buckingham Palace has confirmed the death at Windsor Castle this morning of Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, Queen Elizabeth II's husband at the age of 99. We will have more on that on the late edition on Monocle 24 today at 2100 hours London. The Briefing was produced by Yolin Goffin, Rhys James and Alexa Self. Our studio manager today was Louis Allen. The Briefing returns on Monday at midday UK time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.